Okay, let's get started. Starting today for the next couple of classes, I would be doing, we'll be discussing learning, topics in learning. We will start the general issues in learning the background knowledge that we have just been assuming will come to the agent somehow. Before I continue with the lecture, are there questions? Question? Yes.
I have a question about the final exam. Is that going to be cumulative or just the second part?
Haven't decided. Probably, even if it is cumulative, it will have a larger weight for the second part. Okay, so that's the expectation because first part we already have been testing. By the way, I've been adding problems to homework steadily. I added like 4 or so today, and I might add a couple more, and then I'll stop for that homework and I close it. So you have to keep track of that. Other questions? Okay. Yeah, I like this cartoon. This has no direct connections to today's class, except that in general, in computer science and in AI, when we talk about a classic algorithm, normally classic means like less than 6 years back, okay, and new means last week's algorithm, okay, so, and this was very interesting to me because when I first came as a graduate student to U.S. I was in the Washington D.C. region. I went to University of Maryland, College Park, and one day my friend and I were driving, and we reached the outskirts of this little suburb called Riverdale, and it says, "Entering historic Riverdale, 1934." Started in 1934, which was interesting to me because the front part of the house I lived in my village, was constructed in 1932. And that's the old, that's the newer part. The back part, I don't even know when it was constructed. So classic and early and, you know, historic have different meanings, you know, in different areas, communities, etc., and so on. But I like this because it seems to make that point as well. So we have been talking about, you know, somewhere along the line in the beginning of the semester, we talked about developing an intelligent agent, and we said it needs a bunch of types of action, of knowledge, information about the state, information about how the world evolves, information about what the agent's actions can do to the world, as well as the goals are utilities, okay? Just as a mini review, we looked at utility-based agents when we looked at MDPs, Markov decision processes, and we looked at goal-based agents for most of the rest of the time, including planning and logic. And we looked at how to represent the knowledge about how the world evolves in at least two forms, as logical, propositional or first-order logic representation, or probabilistic, propositional probabilistic logic representation. We looked at those, okay? And we also talked about how to represent what my actions do. You can do it in situation calculus as action axioms. You can do it as a planning operator. You can do it also as dynamic Bayes network. Okay. So we've been doing some of this. And on this side, there are a bunch of questions that the agent asks itself, saying, what's the world like now, which is basically taking the sensory information and the past state information to figure out what's the current world like. Now, when we are doing dynamic Bayes networks, based on the past state and the current sensing information, you re-estimate the current state. So that's the kind of thing that we discussed there. Okay? And we also looked at what would it be like if I do action A. That's basically application of an action. And this whole issue of doing search, you know, considering applying actions is in the forward or the backward direction and figuring out whether you will reach a state where you would be happy. Okay. And then based on this, so basically this part is planning of any kind. And then based on all that, what action can I do now? Okay, so this is sort of the I showed this picture a bunch of weeks back, and then we've been busy doing various topics, and this is sort of a way to try and remember that we did do various pieces in the class which are connected to those boxes. Okay. Now, one question, and in general, this part is, you know, the rectangular boxes really are the inference, are the computational tasks, and these oval boxes are essentially the knowledge that the agent has. Okay. We were sort of strangely silent on how did this knowledge come in. Okay. Who is giving the action descriptions, who is giving the utility information, who is giving model of how the world evolves from one state to another state, where is all this coming from? And the assumption is, you know, if we are writing the agent, we will put this in. Okay, we have to hand code it in. Now, the another possibility is that even if you hand code it in, it can evolve along with the agent and improve the, so the agent basically as it works in the environment, it can improve its knowledge. So you can, as the designer, you can put in some piece of the knowledge, and then it can, based on its successes and failures that it encounters, it can improve its knowledge. So there is clearly a place for learning in this whole picture, which is pretty much any of these things can be learned. Okay? So that's where, you know, from the point of view of learning in intelligent agency, every piece of knowledge that you are giving to the agent, it can learn by itself. Okay? And the question, of course, is, so in a way, if you look at this picture, which is sort of a learning-centric picture, this is a meta-agent sitting on top of the agent. Okay? And the performance element is this agent. And so the learner is sort of, is the part of the agent which is taking, you know, sitting back and seeing, okay, you did an action, how did the world work? Okay? And what were you supposed to be doing? I mean, how well are you supposed to do in this world, you know, in your task, and how did you do? And then the critic basically says, you know, you're screwing up. You know, there are problems. You're not doing well. Okay? And the critic is part of the learning, the learning module. Okay? So now that would then provide feedback saying, you know, these are the ways in which your performance is not good enough. Okay? That's like, for example, saying you play a large chess game at the end of which you're getting the feedback saying you lose. Okay? And now given that, the learning element needs, and the learning element also knows what is the knowledge that the performance element has. So basically think of this whole thing as just one more layer on top of the agent. Okay? So it knows what knowledge the agent has, and it's essentially seeing what changes can I do to its knowledge such that the difference between what is expected and what is actually being done can be reduced. So this is the idea of improving the performance. Okay? The whole point of learning is to improve your performance. Okay? Now, the most obvious way the learning element interacts with the performance element, which is basically your agent, this one, is it just changes. It directly changes the knowledge inside the agent. So for example, it can just go and change this part. Okay, well, you thought that if you close your eyes, the world will stop. Looks like it doesn't. Even if you close your eyes, the world will continue to evolve in the following way. Okay, that's a piece of information that it can do that. And the other issues are things like it can learn new action models. Oh, by the way, this action has this additional effect that you did not know it had. Okay? And then apart from that, so apart from changing the knowledge directly, the another thing that learning element can do essentially is it can set, based on that situation, it can set to it. It can pose certain new goals for the agent. Okay, so remember that Normally, the agent goals might be coming from somebody saying, you know, go achieve this. Okay? But the learning element can also set new goals. And to figure out, to actually work on those, it might generate new problems and give them to the agent. So learning, as part of learning, you sort of generate new problems and solve them. By the way, one useful thing to do in today's class as we discuss this whole thing, and I'll keep repeating it anyway, is to ask your, to try to make an analogy between you, the learner, who learns in classes, and the learning programs that we want to write. Okay? I'm not exactly trying to imitate you, but on the other hand, there are certain very interesting connection between learning as computation and other types of computation that you have seen. Okay, we'll start talking about things like what's a good learning algorithm. That's like asking which of you is a good learner. Okay, and how do I test the performance of a learner? That's like asking how do I set the exam. What is a fair testing of a learning element? That's like asking how do I set a fair test. Okay, so we would keep that in the back of our head. So you could, for example, within that analogy, if you want to learn, if you want to improve your performance, one of the things you can do is you can set yourself new problems, you know, in the area where you think your knowledge is not complete enough. Try to solve them. And solving and work and basically behaving in the environment will give you extra opportunities where the critique can differentiate between what you're doing and what is expected. And that's, again, a new learning opportunity. So you can create learning opportunities yourself. Okay, in this particular case, the learning elements here. Okay, so that's the bigger picture of how learning fits into intelligent agency. Now, just as I looked at this and then for the next several weeks, I wasn't, you know, going back and forth between this picture and the rest of the class. I basically had that in the back of my mind. And similarly, when we are discussing learning too, this is the picture we'll have in the back of our mind, okay? And, you know, there are some types of learning problems which don't, for example, set up new goals, learning goals, for example. Okay, but that's a possibility. That's something that a learning element can do. Okay. Now, in general, if you're talking about designing these learning elements, what sort of dimensions can the problem change in terms of complexity of learning, how is it affected by various types of issues? First of all, what can be learned? What can be learned? Any of these boxes can be learned. Right? So any knowledge can be learned. What feedback is available? Okay? So the question is, when the agent performs in the environment, what feedback is it getting? Once again, this is relevant from your point of view too. So if you're trying to take a course, do you get one feedback, which is just one letter grade at the very end of the course, or would you rather keep getting incremental feedback saying, yeah, you're going fine, you're not going fine? And furthermore, when you get feedback, do you just want to be told, okay, you're doing well, no, you're not doing well, or do you also want to be told that here is your solution, here is the correct solution? Okay, if you can choose, obviously, you know that you want supervised learning, basically a learning scenario where somebody carefully develops a set of problems that you get to work on, and then they compare your solution to the real solution, and from the differences you can learn further. And then you keep getting incremental feedback rather than just at the end of your life. Okay, so this level of feedback available is an important issue in terms of whether learning is easier or harder. So at one extreme, you have fully supervised scenarios where somebody is basically very carefully designing lectures, very carefully designing the training examples and using those training examples, giving the training examples to you, let you solve them, and then compare your solutions, help you compare your solutions to the real solutions, and you continue learning from that. Okay? There's also this issue of graded difficulty of tests. We keep talking about this. I mean, these are things that you know. I mean, you know, why don't we start talking to you about Feynman's atomic model in grade 2? You know, I mean, if I keep repeating it like 15 times, maybe you'll get it in grade 2 itself. Okay. And what's more interesting, why do you get told about Bohr's atomic model in high school when everybody knows that's not correct still? Okay, so we actually do this. This is much of what happens in the formal education is sort of supervised. Of course, some of you may think it's not supervised enough. Some of you might think it's way too supervised, but it's kind of supervised. Okay? And unsupervised is the other extreme, which is nobody tells you nothing. All you know is, now remember that the feedback that is available to you during learning has no bearing on how you are judged in the end. Judgment essentially is how well are you performing. And there's a performance metric for every agent that's externally specified. Okay? So unsupervised essentially means nobody is looking over your shoulder trying to see where you're going. And what's more interesting, of course, is the middle. Not fully supervised, not fully unsupervised, but giving mild morale boosting feedback, okay, or what's called reinforcement learning, where somebody says, yeah, yeah, you're going in the right direction, keep going. Oh, no, you're not going in the right direction, slightly change. Okay? This is reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning has more feedback than unsupervised and less feedback than supervised. And oftentimes, you tend to have, so those are three types of learning problems, depending upon whether it's fully supervised, fully unsupervised, or reinforcement learning. And the techniques that you use to learn could change based on that. Okay? Now, one interesting thing in the case of reinforcement learning, even, in general, is essentially credit assignment problem. Okay, so you do a huge number of things, and in the end, you get some feedback saying you get a C minus. Okay, so the real question is, which of the things that you did should be blamed for the C minus you got? The easiest, of course, is the teacher. But the general idea is, which of the many decisions you did in solving this task should be blamed, either in isolation or collectively, for your performance in the end? And on a chess game, you do a huge number of moves, your opponent does a bunch of moves, you do a bunch of moves, at the end of the game, you lose. Or you win. Which of the moves should get the credit? Okay? In some sense, supervised versus unsupervised versus reinforcement learning can be thought of in terms of how easy it is to solve that credit blame assignment problem. To some extent, when you are doing supervised learning, I tell you, by the way, this step, you know, the one you are thinking of doing right now, which is like going off to a large party for 3 days just before the exam, is not likely to be a good one. Okay? And so you don't have to later on check off the many, many steps which one was the reason why you got the grade you got. Okay? So, In as much as I can help you figure out, especially in a sequential decision problem, which is essentially what an interesting agents are normally involved in, right? You do a sequence of decisions at the end of which you get various cumulative rewards. And which are the decisions that are good ones, which are the decisions that are bad ones? And the moment you can figure out which are the ones that are directly correlated with your reward, final reward, you can then do more of those and less of the bad ones. But the unfortunate thing is, you don't know which are which, other than saying, do the whole thing again and maybe you'll get exactly the same performance. Obviously, you want to do better than that. So think of credit blame assignment problem when you're thinking about level of feedback you're getting, because feedback improves and feedback allows you to solve the credit blame assignment problem easier. Okay. Now, the other interesting dimension in which the learning problems change is the amount of prior knowledge that's available before you started learning. Now, the simplest assumption, of course, is no knowledge is available. So, the only thing that, I mean, so you came into the class with zero knowledge. So, the training examples are the homework and the test during the exam. I mean, no, homework. During the course, and the test is the test, the midterm and the final. Okay, but obviously, so that's one extreme. The other extreme is you know a lot already, and what you're doing is you're trying to do a little more. You're trying to increase your knowledge. Okay, so you're doing learning in the context of pre-existing knowledge. Now, which is more reasonable in terms of what happens to you? Most of the time, we are learning in the context of pre-existing knowledge. In fact, there are, you know, very interesting statements in psychology saying you don't learn anything that you don't already almost know. So unless you almost already know it, you're not going to learn it. Okay? This is why we grade. We first get you through the Bohr atom model to some other model to the total mess that's out there right now, you know, that you will have to read some Stephen Hawking's book or something to figure out that, my God, physics is really bad. Okay? I mean, if I just threw you that book right away, you're not going to. So the background knowledge is often there, and you're always extending with respect to that background knowledge. Okay. Now, one interesting thing, of course, is, well, now that you're older, you have background knowledge. When you were born, did you have background knowledge? Again, you know, I think learning is a topic that has, of course, I mean, AI as a whole is a topic that has large amount of implications to our lives, and of course, learning in particular does. So the question is, when we are we born blank slate? By the way, tabula rasa means blank slate. I didn't know it for the longest time. But anyway, so are you born with a blank slate? That means, you know, nothing in your brain other than just the neurons ready to start firing. Or are you born with a huge amount of background knowledge? And we had this discussion during the semester already once. And the answer is, you'd be surprised how much we already know when we came into this world. Okay, I mean, there's like all sorts of crazy experiments that show, for example, that a two-hour-old baby, you know, shows happy face when, you know, a banana smell is given to it, and sad face when rotten egg smell is given to it. Now, it's easy to think that rotten eggs, you know, some bad things happen to you over rotten eggs, so you're associating badness to rotten eggs. There's nothing wrong about them by itself. But this kid is just born 2 hours back, and unless it's a really bad hospital, they aren't doing anything yet, right? And yet, we are already born to like banana smell, apparently, and to hate rotten egg smell. And babies, when they're born, are actually able to swim. They're able to make moves that keep them afloat for at least a couple of microseconds. And then, after about a month, they sink like stone. Okay? So we are coming into this world with a huge amount of background knowledge. And the best of all this, of course, is the language. I mean, it's so easy, and this is the one we already discussed. Language, it's so easy to believe that, oh, everything you learn, you know, after you come into this world. But really, the current understanding is we are born with a big machine with a bunch of knobs. Okay? And all we are doing when we come into this world are the training examples are essentially are being used to modify those knobs. Okay? So think about something like this. Suppose you're trying to find the distribution of some random variable. Remember, statistics is learning. Well, probability is inference, statistics is learning. And if I'm trying to find the distribution of a random variable, a continuous random variable, I might need a huge number of examples because maybe it has a weirdo distribution which looks like this, right? And I need a large number of examples just to know a good approximation to this distribution. But if I tell you, by the way, this guy has normal distribution, then you don't need as many examples because you know that it's a normal distribution. So the only two parameters that you need to learn are mean and variance. Telling you that it's normal distribution is a huge, huge, you know, favor I'm doing you. Okay? Because then it cuts down the number of examples you need to learn. Now, this also actually brings up the issue which we will discuss again in the class. What makes learning easy versus hard? What makes learning easy versus hard in terms of complexity of learning is how many examples do you need before you can reach a certain level of performance. Okay? And so, if both you and your friend are trying to, you know, make a decision based on the distribution of this random variable, your friend has been told that this random variable is a normally distributed random variable. You have not been told that, so you're trying to just figure it out from the example. How many examples do you need versus your friend needs to reach the same level of performance? Clearly, your friend will need much fewer. Okay, and in fact, one of the reasons, going back to the kids and the language theory, the reason why people realized that kids have to come into this world with a huge amount of linguistic knowledge is because of this beautiful phrase called poverty of stimulus. Okay, kids start making sentences by the time they are like 2.5, 3, 4, you know, in that range. Okay? There is not enough examples that they have seen of people talking to explain how they are able to make these complex sentences. Okay? And so this is where people started worrying. There has to be another explanation than people just kids picking up everything just from the example. And the other explanation turns out to be that they're coming into the world with, you know, what's called, more or less, what we believe is a universal grammar, and what they're doing is using the examples to just tune the knobs on the universal grammar, which is like coming into the world with information saying this variable is normal distribution, and using the examples just to figure out mean and variance, as against coming into the world not knowing what the distribution of this variable is, and using the examples to figure that out. Okay, so prior knowledge is important. Now, having said this, so I said what sort of feedback, so in terms of feedback available in the normal learning task, where do you think is the, what is likely to be the more general learning task? In most general learning tasks, do you think they're going to be supervised, fully unsupervised, or reinforcement learning oriented? No clue? Yes? Sort of, right? Because it can't be either of the extremes, and nobody is holding your hands all the time, and nobody is throwing you out to the dogs all the time either, you know? So it's like probably you're getting reinforcement learning, okay? And yet, it's much easier to solve learning problems which are fully supervised. And it also turns out it's also easier to solve learning problems which are fully unsupervised. Okay? And so, a lot of learning research is done with supervised and unsupervised problems. Not because that's the most interesting problem. That's because it's easier to do. Okay, this is, of the drunk searching for her keys. I decided it's going to be a woman drunkard this time. Under the light, you know, this story. So there's a drunkard who is searching for the keys under the street light. So somebody asks, so what are you doing? He says, you know, she says, I'm searching for the keys that I lost. And they ask, so did you lose them here? He says, no, I didn't lose them here. I lost them somewhere there. And why are you searching here? The light is here. That's why I'm searching here. Okay? And much of research sometimes tends to be that way. You know, the harder problems are out there. There's more light here. So we work here. Okay, and you need to understand that, because where is the harder problems versus where is the research going on. Okay, so between supervised and unsupervised reinforcement, you would think it's sort of the middle is the more interesting part, but there's a lot more work in the end because the lights, the searchlights are there. Between prior knowledge being there versus no prior knowledge being there, which do you think is the more reasonable learning problem to work on? Prior knowledge being there. which is the one that's easier. It turns out not having anything in your head is easier. And so much of the learning that we will talk about, and in fact, including, you know, I guess the current state of the art learning is to really hope that there is no prior knowledge. Okay, the only thing that the learner knows about this problem is the training examples. And if there is learning knowledge, if there is prior knowledge at all, it's very grudgingly introduced. Okay, and it's important to keep this. I mean, this slide is probably the last time you will ever realize that learning actually does have prior knowledge. If you take a bunch of machine learning courses, bunch of data mining courses, you should ask yourself, what happened to all the knowledge that we used to have? Why is it that the only thing that we have is the example? Yes, sir. What? No, writing programs which know how to effectively use prior knowledge is difficult. Okay, the classic example for me is height balance trees versus binary trees. This is my classic example. Okay, height balance trees are a harder concept. Nobody really wants to teach that. Nobody really wants to learn them. Binary trees are so much easier to understand. Okay, but it's not because height balance trees are somehow more complex. And in fact, if you have the chance, you should be doing height balance trees. Okay, it's poverty of our imagination rather than the difficulty of the task. Okay. So we haven't yet figured out good algorithms that can use background knowledge effectively. We will see some of them, but you know, that's where it is. But we know it should be used because the only intelligent beings that we see, which is basically us, you know, it's so nice, seem to have it. Right? Yes?
Is it because if you have some prior knowledge, or say prejudice in this case, it's harder to pick case examples with two stones, prejudice
and prior knowledge? I don't know. I mean, no. In fact, all I know is we do have prior knowledge. And prior knowledge sometimes can actually hurt you in learning something easily. Okay, my prior knowledge basically, different kinds of prior knowledge might bias you to away from the good hypothesis. I mean, again, I'm using terms that I'll explain in a minute, bias and hypothesis. Okay, and sometimes, but most of the time, you hope that the prior knowledge helps you bias towards good hypothesis. Okay, but giving up on prior knowledge just because it might bias you towards the, you know, bad hypothesis seems silly, because that way we wouldn't be where we are. That means every day we should wash our head along with our teeth and our, you know, hair, because we don't need to have any. We are worried that the prior knowledge will actually get us into trouble. That makes no sense. Okay. Questions on this? Single slide took forever, but I think this is the general background on learning algorithms, spectrum of them. And then we'll start talking about very specific cases for which we can talk about algorithms. But once in a while, you have to come back and see what are the dimensions, okay? And what are we not doing? Here is another slide which basically says, like, for example, different kinds of performance elements. So the idea is what you learn depends on what your agent looks like and what kind of knowledge it uses. So if your agent is a problem-solving agent, most of this stuff would not be declaratively represented. Okay, if it's a logical agent, these would be represented in, you know, first order logic or propositional logic. If it is a probabilistic agent, it would be represented in some sort of Bayes network, a dynamic Bayes network. Okay, and so what you are learning depends on what representation the current knowledge is in and what is the representation that the performance element can use. Okay. So for example, if your performance element is alpha beta search, you basically have to learn evaluation function, which can be represented as sort of a weighted linear function of features. And the kind of feedback you get in that scenario is, well, you won or lost an entire game. Okay. If it's a logical agent, it could learn transition model, which is basically how actions influence the world. and the representation is logical axioms, you know, the situation calculus axioms or successor state axioms. For utility-based agents too, you would have a transition model, and I guess they use utility here, but that's because decision theoretic agents normally deal with both uncertainty and utility. Okay, and so you might wind up having a representation of dynamic Bayes net, and so you would learn both the topology of the Bayes net and the conditional probability tables of the Bayes net. Yes. Before the. No. Before I started, before you came to this class, what did you know? Okay, to the extent this class gives you both training examples and the test, what did you know before you came into this class? So before you started, you know, the learning task, what did you already know about the learning task? Or another way of saying is, anything other than the training example is prior knowledge, essentially. Okay? And then, you know, you could also have somebody who has a percept action function, you know, something like a simple reflex agent, which takes the sensory inputs and directly maps them into the action to be done in the world. And so it has 15 actions, and sensory inputs are coming in real numeric form, okay, and signals, and then you need to map them into some, you know, one of these 15 actions, right? And that could be a reasonable representation for that are neural networks, which are essentially a generalized description of functions, which threshold the signals at different layers and then come out with discrete outputs at the end. Okay? So depending on now, so in some sense we need to learn logical axioms, we need to learn Bayes networks, we also need to learn these kinds of neural networks, depending on what you're trying to what task, what functional performance element you're trying to improve. Okay? This is just repetition of all I said about supervised versus unsupervised versus reinforcement learning and the background knowledge. I already talked about this, so I won't go through this again. So now what I'll do is stick to a very specific learning task. So what's interesting is all the things that I'm leaving out, okay? The learning task I'm going to use is the following thing. Given a set of, so this is basically called inductive learning or concept learning or classification learning, okay? The idea is this. Given a set of labeled training examples, okay? So for each example, you say, yes, it is an example of my concept. No, it's not an example of my concept. Okay? That's the part about labeled. And training examples, because I'm giving it to you during the training phase. What you're trying to do is, really what you're trying to do is sort of internalize these examples, and now I'll test you by giving some test examples whose labels I know, you don't know. And you are supposed to do well in the test. You should be able to guess the labels correctly. And there is a sort of an intermediate step that I will sort of postulate that the way you would go from here to here might be that you would find a rule that underlies this labeling. And then you will just keep applying that rule. So you're looking for a pattern in the example. Now the interesting thing is All I need to do is go from here to here, I don't really need this intermediate step. I can say the training examples are the best description of the training example. So I just keep the training examples, and a new test example comes, I somehow compare it to all the training examples and see which does it look most like and take the label of that example as a label for the training example. If you do this, by the way, if you understand this, you already know one learning algorithm. This is called nearest neighbor algorithm. So the nearest neighbor learning algorithm says, I won't do this. You give me the training examples and their labels. I just keep them in my hand, and when you give me new examples, I will compare it to my training examples, see which is the training example that the test example is closest to, and whatever is the label for that, I'll give that label to the training example, a test example. And there's a variation of this nearest neighbor algorithm called K nearest neighbor algorithm. K nearest neighbor learning algorithm essentially says, I'll take the test example, look for K of the training examples that are closest to this test example, and look at what is the majority label over this K training example. So if K is, you know, 10, then I look for 10 closest examples to the one test example I have. Okay? And then whichever is the, and if of those 10, 7 of them are saying plus and 3 of them are saying minus, then the majority relation is plus. So you will say test example is plus. Now, the thing that K nearest neighbors doesn't do is it does not go from examples to any intermediate representation. It's not looking for patterns. We are interested in looking for patterns also, because part of what we would hope is the pattern we learn can then go be, and can then be written here. If you don't do any patterns, then in essence you would be doing sort of a simple reflex agent, which has a big table saying for this, do this. For this, do this. And we already sort of said simple reflex agents don't work that well. Okay? So K nearest neighbor is actually a beginning idea that you should understand, and in fact you should not do, I mean you should always compare yourself to K nearest neighbor algorithm. Okay? Now here is a trick question actually, and I won't answer it right now. What's the trickiest part of NN, nearest neighbor algorithm? What is the part that I'm not telling you? What? Yeah. Everybody said, yeah, you know, close one, yeah, it makes sense. But that's the reason nearest neighbor algorithms are popular, because everybody thinks they understand them. Okay? That basically what you're saying is these are like, if it's, you know, these are like, what are those, you know, mortgage in things, the bubble mortgages or something, where it makes it sound as if it's a very simple learning algorithm, but everything that you need is in the distance function. The distance function takes two examples and tells you how distant or how close they are. Now, unfortunately, figuring out the right distance function is figuring out everything. If you figured out the right distance function, then you know something about the domain. What happens normally is people assume that if the examples are all represented as some n-dimensional vector, x1, etc., up to xn, okay, if the example is represented as an n-dimensional vector, okay, and then its label is positive, and there's a test example which is x1 dash, etc., up to xn dash, and you are trying to figure out what its label is, so you need to figure out the distance between this vector and this vector. But everybody thinks they know how to compute the distance between vectors. Just do the Euclidean distance. Never mind that it does not have to make any sense whatsoever. You understand? So much of what happens in doing nearest neighbors is to try and get the right representation for the examples such that the Euclidean distance or something will work well. So it's not that nearest neighbor algorithms are all that easy. It's just that the distance function has to be specified, and once you specify them, you can compute the label for the test example. Okay? But we would concentrate more on this idea that you'll first try to learn some rule, a representation of the pattern that's underlying the example. And once you find the pattern, then you throw the examples out. You no longer keep the examples around with you. It's just this rule that, that you will be using. Okay? Yes. Actually, we'll talk about what the complexity of learning is in a minute. In general, the issue of complexity of learning has to be tied to not the amount of time taken by the learner, but the number of examples taken. Okay? Think about the following thing. What's the difference between a slow student and a fast student who keeps getting A pluses and the slow student who doesn't seem to be getting A pluses? There was a professor in this department, who used to tell me that she would understand the entire course 1 week after the final exam was over. Now, in a grand scheme of things, that's way better than most people who go through their entire life not understanding a thing. This woman understood everything about that class 1 week after the exam, final exam. But her grades, of course, weren't good because the final exam was on a particular day. And you just understood it all afterwards. Okay. So in trying to compare learners, you are talking not only about how fast people learn, it's also how many examples do they need before they can master the concept. Some people see one example and get it. Some people require large number of worked out examples before they start getting it. And some people can be given infinite number of examples and they'll still never get it. Okay. So, in fact, when we are talking about comparing learner 1 and learner 2, you can draw pictures, not of people, but of their performance. So, number of training examples. So, think about it this way. This woman I was talking about, if the semester was semester plus 7 days, she would be getting A pluses. But the semester was not semester plus 7 days. And so she was getting C minuses. Maybe not, but you know, bad grades. Okay? So the question is the number of training examples, and so if you are given, let's say, 100 training examples, and you use these examples to figure out the concept, and then I'm testing you on the test examples, what's your performance? How often are you correct in labeling the test examples? This is 0 to 100% correct. Okay. Now, here is learner 1. Here is learner 2. Here is learner 3. Here is learner 4. A different learner. Okay, I mean, if I had my choice, I would like to be this. Because I need the fewest examples to reach 100% accuracy. This lady I was talking about was more like this. She needed a few more examples, but she would reach 100% accuracy. And any day I would be higher than this guy, who shows tremendous progress in the beginning and then just flattens out. In the sense, the learner is not powerful enough to actually reach 100% accuracy. In fact, we will see, for example, that a decision tree learner, a neural network learner of a particular type called perceptron learner is extremely fast in what it learns. But in most cases, it can't learn what you are trying to teach it. So it will very quickly reach its 20% accuracy level and stays there. And then the worst of all is this, right? This particular learner is taking many, many examples to get anywhere. Okay, and you need to understand the distinctions between these types of learners. Okay, I mean, normally when you draw pictures, you hope that your algorithm is this, your friend's is this or this. Okay, so that you can say your algorithm looks better. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, So here is, I think I sort of answered some of these issues. So given a set of label training examples, find a rule that underlies the labeling so that you can use it to predict future unlabeled examples. And this task is called inductive learning, and you assume in this case, so now in this case, is there any prior knowledge? In the specification of the problem, there is nothing other than the training example. So it's an example of learning task where there is no prior knowledge. Is it supervised? Yes, because the training examples have been given the labels. The training examples have been given the labels upfront. And so it's supervised learning task. Okay? And this is the simplest idea, and this is goes under the name classification learning or inductive learning, and we will look at this a bit in the next, for today as well as probably next class. Okay? Now here's my question. There are several questions with just this example, this problem. One is, how are training examples represented? What are these training examples I'm talking about? Okay? In general, you have to make an assumption, and the most general assumption that people make is that the training example is a vector of, it's a feature vector. So it's a vector of n features, okay? And these features can be Boolean, that means they're true or false. They can be discrete but not Boolean, that means each feature can have, three or four different values. Or most interestingly, they could be continuous variables, or they could be a mix, okay? So I'm assuming in most of these classification learning tasks, you somehow assume that the training examples are represented as a vector over some feature space. Test examples would also be represented as a vector over the feature space. What you're trying to do, and then for the training examples, you give a vector and you say a plus or minus, true or false, for the concept. Now, inductive learning turns out to be, classification learning turns out to be a special case of the general idea called function learning. Because if you think of training examples as an array vector, then each training example is really a point in the n-dimensional space. Each training example is a point in the n-dimensional space. Okay? Now, I can actually say the function, consider the following function, which takes x1 to xn and gives y, which is the label for this example. In a way, if I can learn the closed form solution for this function, that could be what the rule is. So ultimately, classification learning is function learning. So I'm showing you the points on the function, and you are supposed to learn the function. Okay? Now, in classification learning, the function has only two values, true or false. But more generally, a function can have any number of values. It can actually be a real-valued function. Okay? And in that specific case, where the function actually can be, it's not just, if it is plus or minus, or if it is 1 or 0, then it's normally called classification learning. If it is just a real number, then what you're trying to do is learning any general function. That's called regression. Regression is the idea of given examples of points on a function, figure out the equation for the function, expression for the function. It's exactly like statistics. Given samples, figure out the probability distribution. Okay? So, in the most general sense, learning is function. This kind of inductive learning is function learning. Okay, and the representation, as I said, is a vector of features. And here is one example. These are vectors of Boolean features. No, these could be vectors of discrete features, not Boolean. These are a bunch of examples which are describing whether Stuart Russell would wait for service in a restaurant or not. Okay? And it's basically this example is telling you, in this example, I mean, so the question is, how are the examples defined? These examples are defined in terms of a bunch of features. Okay? And the features here that he used are whether there's an alternative for this restaurant. You know, and is there a bar in the restaurant? Is it a Friday? Are there enough patrons in the restaurant? How pricey is it? Is it raining outside? And, you know, some of them I don't even remember. What type of cuisine is it? And what's the estimated wait time? These are the features with which the examples have been described. Okay? And you are following, you're stalking, you know, Stuart, and figured out that in these 12 cases, you exactly knew whether he waited or did not wait for the restaurant. And your life aim now is tomorrow, if he goes to a particular restaurant, whether he would wait or not wait. Silly, but an example of inequality. But I could have said this is a different scenario. The examples could have been the different credit card transactions, and what you're trying to guess is whether the transaction is fraudulent or non-fraudulent. And every credit card company does this these days. So if I go, so the other day, I was in England, and my wife was here, and we have one card, both of us have different names, of course, and I was charging it in Lake District in England, and she was charging for her gas price, gas or something in Tempe, and all of a sudden I start getting mails and calls saying, what's going on? Okay, so somebody, in the mass of transactions that are going on, they realize there is something fishy going on with this credit card transaction, because how is this guy able to do physical transactions? Because notice that I could be doing online transactions and they couldn't have cared. But they knew that the transaction I was doing there was a physical transaction. And it turns out credit card transactions has the card been swiped or not swiped? That's part of the information they have about the transaction. So I swiped my card in Lake District, while at the same time my card was being swiped in here. And they were worried. You know, was there a divorce in the family? What's going on? Okay. And how did they figure out whether to call me or not? They were able to look at examples of fraudulent versus non-fraudulent transactions. They learned some patterns about how to predict fraudulent transactions. And then they are applying it to it. Okay. My wife one time gave money to a couple of Sierra Club type organizations. Every possible nature conservancy organization sends her letters. I actually like nature, but nobody sent me any junk mail. Not that I'm asking you to send them mail to send me junk mail. Why? Because they have figured out that he fits the profile. Okay, now what is this profile business we are talking about? It's because they have looked at enough examples of the junk mails that were sent to various people, who are the kinds of people who are responding for what kind of mail. And those are the guys, keep sending them more of these. And it's just amazing how the junk mail transactions work. You know, it's like 0.0001% of spam mails are actually clicked on. That is more than enough for the spam email to survive well into the next millennium. Whereas in the postal junk mail, you need slightly higher percentage of returns because they're actually spending real money. Okay? So it could have been a classification task for credit card transactions. It could have been classification task of how to respond to and who is likely to respond to junk mail. And you could think of anything else too. It could have been a classification task of whether you are likely to be interested in the following books. That's what Amazon is trying to tell me. And most of the time they're unfortunately right. You know, I mean, I just feel so bad that I'm profileable. But they give these, you know, books which I seem to like. And how did they figure this out? They didn't come and ask me. They just looked at feature-based representations of all the books that I have looked at And all those are the positive examples. The other ones which I clicked but I didn't read, I mean I didn't buy, the negative examples, and they're able to use that to figure out what to send. Okay. So within this single idea, there is, you know, variety of application, different tasks can be done actually. Okay. And it's also of course function learning, as I said. Now other questions are, the first question was how does the examples represented, and the other is the one thing that I want you to ask yourself is, again, I said examples are represented as features slightly. Okay. It turns out the maximum help I can do to my learning algorithm is to figure out what are the best features to write about. For example, don't look at what are the features that are listed here. Look at the number of millions and millions of features about the real world scenario of Russell going to a restaurant that are not listed. What's the color of his socks? Was his hair mussed up or not? How many pockets did he have on his shirt? You know, how many cards were there in his, you know, I'm making these up, and you can make up more of these. And for each of them, you can draw one more column and give that information too. The fact that you did not give, you, the teacher, did not give that information to the learner was your way of helping the learner. Providing features is the best thing anybody can do. Okay? And in fact, so what we are doing is that teacher already kind of figured out it's somehow related to these, and then only these features are being given, and then it makes it much easier to do the learning task. As against being given the, for example, the entire description of the space-time continuum corresponding to each of the Russell restaurant waiting scenarios and saying yes and no in it. Okay? Again, always ask yourself, what are people not telling you? Okay, that by not telling you that, they're helping you in some way. Okay. Now, how do we test the learner on this kind of a problem? How would we test the learner? Well, you have training examples, and you are going to, are you supposed to be doing well on the test examples or the training examples? Everybody likes to have the homework problems repeated on the exam, because at least they know how to copy the answer, especially if it is take home, it's even better. Okay, but no, test is different from training examples. Now, here's my question. So first of all, there is a bunch of training examples on which you're being judged. There's a bunch of training examples on which you're being trained, and there's a bunch of test examples on which you're being judged. And what does it mean to do well in the test scenario? In this particular inductive scenario, if you give the label, that is the correct label, then you win. If not, you lose. You can give wrong label in two ways. The real test example is a positive example, but you say it's a negative example. Then that would be what? A false negative. It was really a positive, you said it's a negative. So it's a false negative. The other is, it's really a negative example and you said positive. Then it's a false positive. The perfect learner will always have zero false positives and zero false negatives on every possible test scenario. And it's impossible to construct. Okay? Perfect learner has zero positive, false positives and zero false negatives across the board. Now, normally what you would have is learners which have some finite number of false and negative, false positives and false negatives. Now, the question then is, if a learner has two false positives, zero false negatives, another one has zero false positives, two false negatives, are they equal or one better than the other? By default, we assume any kind of error is equally bad. So false positive is equally bad compared to false negative. That's not always the case. In fact, depending on the problem domain, it may well be that the false positives are much worse than false negatives. Okay? When did you hear the word false positive in a bad connotation, giving a bad connotation. What? Drug testing. Being stopped in the airport because you look like somebody's profile of what a terrorist would look like. Those are false positives. Okay? What is a false negative? You got tested on some disease, and then you actually had the disease, and they said, no, you didn't have that disease. So, in a medical scenario, false negatives are penalized more. If you actually have the disease and the procedure fails to detect it, you're going to sue the heck out of them later on if you live to find that out. Okay? So in the junk mailing domain, false negatives are penalized much less. Because, you know, what if this guy is not likely to actually respond? I think he's going to respond, but he's not likely to respond. That's okay. I'll send some more mails, especially if it is junk email. Okay? So the point I'm trying to make is, depending upon the actual application, it is actually possible that the false positives and false negatives have very different costs. But in the default scenario, we assume false positives and false negatives are equally bad. Okay? If you actually give different costs to different kinds of errors, then it's called cost-based learning. And so, for example, in a medical domain, what is this statement? Let 100 criminals go free than to punish an innocent. What is it saying? Avoid false positives. And there's a version of that by Chief Wiggum, which I really like, which says, let 100 criminals go free than chase after them, which is much nicer. There are nice connections. I mean, we do differentiate between the different kind of errors learners make. But in the simplest scenario, we assume all errors are created equal. Okay. One more point how are learners tested is this, and then can learners ever work? Do we actually believe that learning is possible? Think of the odds. I give you training examples on which you train, and I give you test examples on which I test you. There are three possible scenarios. Scenario one, training and test examples are one and the same. It's easy to learn, but it's a useless learning task. Okay? Scenario number two, training and test examples have no connection whatsoever. It's easy to learn there too. Basically, just ignore the training examples and keep tossing coins. You can't do any work. By the way, any learning example, so if you are learning classification, if you're doing classification learning, right, what's the worst possible accuracy you, the learner, can have? I assume that it's a binary concept. It can either be positive or negative. What is the truly worst possible accuracy a learner can have? What? 50%. You know why? Why not 20%? If you have a learner which is 20% correct, just do the opposite of it. You're 80% correct. You know, this is another Seinfeld thing I was just seeing. I mean, there's a Seinfeld episode where George says, if your every instinct is wrong, then the opposite of your instinct must be right. Right? And so he starts doing the anti-George thing. So, in fact, the worst learners are the 50% learners. Those are the ones that cannot be improved. Okay, if they're actually less than 50, then you do the opposite of them and you get going. Okay? It's a nice thing to remember, I mean, you know. So the question then is, if the training and test examples have no connection whatsoever, you can basically you may as well just toss a coin. That does as well as anybody can. Okay, so again, learning is trivial. So where is learning feasible? Why do we believe that there is such a thing called a fair test in an exam, in a class, fair exam in a class? Okay, I mean, this is It'll get me good grades, good evaluations, right? You know, the same questions on the homework come in the exam, but nothing is actually being tested. This doesn't help. You know, it'll make you unhappy, but neither are you learning anything. Okay, because I taught you about all this stuff, and all the questions are, you know, in the final exam are NP completeness proofs, which are important, but, you know. Why do we think, so a fair test is one that's neither this nor this, but somehow training and test examples are related. You know, you assume that the final exam questions are somehow connected to the homework, etc., that you did. That's what we tend to decide whether a test is fair or not. What's more interesting, I mean, my wife has taken a course on computational, I think, equivalent of CSC 355, slightly advanced version, where the last half a class, the professor taught how to do NP completeness proofs. And the final exam, 89% of the questions were NP completeness proofs. Okay. And she has taken this class with another person who is a professor at Duke. My wife is a professor here. And they met after, what, 15 years in Washington, D.C. And when they recognized each other, first thing they talked about is how bad this exam was. Okay. People remember these things for years on. Okay. Well, he did teach NP completeness, right? Why did we say it's an unfair test? Because the test examples and the training examples are not from the same distribution. It was like only 3% of the time was spent during the semester on NP completeness, but 89% of the exam was about NP completeness. It's not just related, you want the distribution to be the same. So really, the fair learning, to the extent we believe learning is possible, we believe that because the test examples we assume are being chosen from the same distribution as the training example. To the extent that that assumption is right, learning is feasible. If not, it's not feasible. Okay? If I try, you know, if I teach you about all this stuff and I ask you about NP completeness, I can be pretty darn sure that you will do badly. Okay, and that doesn't teach me anything, that doesn't tell me anything about the performance of the learner itself. Okay. So this idea is important. Learning is feasible because we assume training and test examples are taken from the same distribution. Okay. Okay, we'll end with this today. So we talked about some of the issues in actually making inductive learning feasible. And the final question, of course, is, I said learning is feasible if the distribution is the same for the training and test examples. Then what's the goal of writing a learning algorithm? Well, the goal is make a learner that would classify all new instances correctly always, all test instances correctly always. That's the goal. Now, let's ask whether that makes sense. Always? Can you always correctly label the training example, label the test example? Maybe the training examples are not completely representative of the test samples. Maybe they are not, even if they are from the same distribution, there is a probabilistic, there's a probability that you would still be mislabeling one of the test cases. Okay? So what we really would like to do is we would be probably correct on the test sample with a high probability. Okay? And then the other part is correctly. We are supposed to correctly classify. Now the question is, maybe it's impossible to correctly classify because the training examples were wrong to begin with. So I gave wrong answers in the homework, but I used the right answers to test you in the exam. Another way of getting, you know, making people happy about me, right? So if the training examples are wrong, then you don't, even the best learner cannot actually learn, okay? So really, and possibly, furthermore, this could be have been done intentionally, which I hope it's not. It could also have been done because of noise Okay, so for example, this guy who's following Russell from restaurant to restaurant, right, one day he thought that Russell sat down at the restaurant to wait, you know, and then he walked away. But then right after this guy left, Russell actually left that restaurant and went to another restaurant. So actually the example is Russell leaves. But the guy who was stalking Russell was impatient, and so he gave the wrong label. So here's a training example that was wrong. Okay, there is noise in the training example. Because there is noise in the training examples, you really can't insist on complete correctness. You have to say approximately correct. What approximately correct means is, if I give 100 test examples, if my learner correctly labels 99 of them, that's 0.99 correct, or error of 0.01. What probably correct means that, so I give it 100 test examples today, it did 99 of them correct. I give another 100 tomorrow for the same learner, it does 10 of them correct. So tomorrow's error is really bad compared to today's error. But then after tomorrow, forever and ever, it's still doing 99 of the 100 examples correct. So there was a blip on the screen. One particular test, it failed. But rest of the time, it's doing quite well. Okay, so then it's probably correct with probability of 99 or 100. So in particular, we would be looking to design learners which are probably, approximately correct. That sounds like the best wishy-washy thing anybody can say. But it's the most technical thing I'm saying today. Okay? This is stack learning. Probably approximately correct in the sense that given an epsilon and a delta, epsilon is the error rate, and delta is the probability that you would only have error rate of epsilon or less. Okay? Then a learner is epsilon delta pack if it is going to guarantee that over a long period of time, its error, the probability that it will do more than epsilon error is less than delta. What is the complexity of learning then? Complexity of a learning task is how many examples are needed, how many examples are needed to complete, to learn a concept in the pack sense, in the epsilon delta sense. As long as the number of examples needed is a polynomial in terms of epsilon and delta, then you say it's easy learnable. If it is exponential in epsilon and delta, then it's a hard learning task. Okay? So this is, we used to think of complexity of computation as you start the program and see how long it takes, it's n cube, n power, whatever, you know. We are talking completely different way of thinking of complexity of an algorithm. This is sample complexity. How many samples do you need to reach a certain level of accuracy? And you compare learning algorithms by essentially doing these learning curves of the type I showed you. And to reach the same level of accuracy, how many samples do these learning algorithms take? Okay? So we'll come back next class and start going, whizzing past a bunch of learning algorithms which can try to stack learn various types of concepts.